You are now listening to the Film Situation Podcast.
We're so pleased to have Hillary Duncanson on the Film Situation Podcast. Welcome, Hillary.
Thank you, Zev. Thank you very much for inviting me here today.
The pleasure is all mine.
Wonderful. I'm glad you're happy. He's smiling, you know?
So, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you started acting in the motion pictures.
All right. I'm going to go back to the beginning a little bit. I used to do this when I was in grade school. I did plays. The next thing you know, I was in high school and I did plays. And then I went to college and I did a few things. And that was the end of it. I met my wife. I got married. And I hadn't done anything lately of merit for about several decades, 30, 35 years or something like that, 35. Next thing you know, I was home, and my son Jeffrey, who was involved with this business, this showbiz, if whatever you want to call it.
And I should preface that Jeffrey's a good friend of mine, and I've worked with him on several productions. Really talented guy. He was the cinematographer of Westway. Worked with him as a Steadicam operator on The Smiler and on a bunch of other things where he's served as gaffer. And yeah, good friend of ours. So go ahead.
In early 2013, my son comes walking over to me and he said, Dad, he says, oh, Owen wants you to see if you can help him with a student film. I said, what does he want me to do? Lug his equipment around or something or do something? Oh, no, he wants you to go and read some lines for him. I said, I haven't done that in 30, 35 years or something. I haven't done it in a long time. Well, don't worry about it. You can go down there and check it out and do this and that and the other thing. I said, okay, calm down. I'll do it. So anyway, I drive down to Brooklyn, and I'm on Quincy Street in Brooklyn, and I'm running up to this sort of funny-looking apartment of a flight of stairs that I thought was going to crash beneath my feet, and I meet this young fellow named Owen. And Owen said, glad to meet you, and we had little niceties there, and we went along a little bit, and the next thing you know, he has me reading lines, you know, from this student film of his. And the student film was entitled, or still is entitled, Foul Play. And I say foul with F-O-W-L, foul.
Gotcha,
Yes. It was curious. I said, I wonder what this is about. He told me, I said, who's the star? He said, a chicken. I said, a chicken? Are you kidding? He said, no. He said, this chicken is going to be from Connecticut. I said, Connecticut? Are you kidding? No.
The chicken was a seasoned pro.
A seasoned pro. It was a professional chicken, apparently, for some reason. And the name of the chicken was Shiloh. It was a little small chicken or something. I don't know. Anyway, I start reading this script, and I'm finding out it is a student film from Pratt Institute on Willoughby Street in Brooklyn. I said, oh, that's a very prestigious place. I'm sort of honored to do this. I'm very nice. And I thought to myself, gee, this is not small-time stuff. So I start reading the lines with him and blah, 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 blah. And after I read the lines a few times, he said to me, I think you can do the part. But he said, you'll first have to, we're going to go and I'm going to have you warmed up with a professional acting coach they have, that does these things. I said, who is it? He said, it's a girl by the name of Joanne Carlo. So anyway, a week or so later, I'm up reading the script in Joanne Carlo's apartment right next to CBS, I didn't say CBS, I'm thinking about drugs too much, CBS on 56th Street, I think it was, 10th Avenue, something like that. Next thing you know, I'm reading this stuff and blah, 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 blah. And this was a four-hour straight training course. It was the first ever professional acting training I had ever had in my entire life. And I had lived quite a few years at that time. So I'm sitting there. And so we're going back. And before I know it, she's actually sounding my voice, you know, mimicking my own voice. I couldn't believe it. It was true. It's true. And I kept going along, and after about an hour or half of this, took a glass of Coke or something, Coca-Cola, sat down again, and I said to her, Joanne, I said, I'm no spring chicken. My face was not as what it was years ago. She said to me, you got the face. I immediately shut up, and I talk a lot, as you can tell already, and I actually was quiet for a while. They were very quiet. I was like the stone, like a rock of Gibraltar. I didn't move. I didn't say a word. Next thing you know, we're going along. And this was 4 hours straight. I want to tell you, this is like Paris Island. It was like I was even sweating. I mean, finally we get through this stuff and we're going through it. Owen is sitting there observing everything. And finally, I said, Joanne, my voice is not what it used to be back in the day when I was doing this stuff. She looked me straight in the face and said, you got the face, and you did. If you didn't have that face, we would have fired you already. And I really shut up then, and I didn't say another word, and off we go, blah, blah, blah. And we finally, all of a sudden, she invited us to have dinner with her, and she made some beautiful hamburgers for us and a nice Chinese green salad. And I had told Owen I was going to bring her a bag of cashew nuts and a bottle of red wine. And we sat down and had the most delicious hamburgers and a wonderful supper and everything else, right? Then we finally finished up, and as we left the apartment, after all this was over, I was in a sweat. I go downstairs, and I said, who is this woman? And he said, oh, a friend of the family, friend of the family. I said, oh, friend of the family, that's very nice. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Later on, of course, I think I mentioned this a few times to people, that Owen has a very famous father. And I should tell this now because it's really part of what you get yourself into when you become an actor, a freelance actor. I found out, first of all, that Joanne Carlo's cousin is Patty LuPone. I said, Patty LuPone? Holy moly, that's unbelievable. I said, who's this Owen guy? Oh, his father is a famous actor. I said, who is he? Kevin Kline. I said, oh, Kevin Kline? Oh, my God, I can't believe that. When all of a sudden, I find myself shrinking, like a shrinking violet. They use the phrase shrinking. I got very cold and clammy. I said, oh, my God, I better behave myself here. And so anyway, after a number of weeks of rehearsal, we went on, and we went on location in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and we went to Manville, New Jersey on location. We were in Bensonhurst. We were in various, in Bushwick, in Brooklyn. And we did a 13-minute thing, a student film, which was received quite well by the audience there when we went to see the premiere over at Pratt.
Was that Owen's first film?
This was not Owen's first film. Apparently, Jeffrey used to do films with very short films out in Central Park and things like that. But I have a feeling that this was probably his first film which had an order to it.
Right, like it was a step up for him.
It was a sort of a step up for him in a way. Although I think, oh, no, wait. Owen, I'm sorry, I take it back. He was in a movie as an actor. You know what the movie was, right?
The Squid and the Whale.
The Squid and the Whale. The Squid and the Whale. With Jesse Eisenberg and Noah Baumbach.
Great film.
Yeah. That's a great film with Laura Linney.
I forget now, he played Jesse Eisenberg's brother.
Yes, the younger brother.
That's right. That's right.
He did.
And it was a great film.
It was terrific. And the thing is, so this is how I entered into the film world. So I have to say, and I told these young people here with us today, that I really stepped in something there, and this is what happens. Sometimes, you know, you always hear these actors saying, I got a break, and so I had a little break there. And so I figured that's going to be the end of this forever, you know what I mean? And let me tell you what happened next. Next thing you know, I got an email from a guy named Charlie Cole. Charlie Cole was a contemporary of Owen's at Pratt, and he was in his class. He calls me up and he says, "Hey, Hillary, he says you think you could come help us out? We want you to play an actor in the subway, an obsessed old guy in the subway." And I said, well, I'm always obsessed in the subway. I'm looking around all over the place, obsessed. And the next thing you know, I'm down on St. Mark's Place in his apartment he had in New York with his cousin, James Cole, who was the producer, who was doing it for a girl by the name of Caroline Reese, who was a singer and did a cover song. It was done by one of these famous groups or something. And next thing you know, I'm in there doing this pantomime, if you will, of an old obsessed guy. And at two days later, we finished the thing. It was quite intense. And we got out of it, and I went back to the apartment, and they handed me an envelope. I was telling these young people before. The envelope had some cash in there. I said, what's this? That's your comp, they said. I said, I get comped? Wow, this is pretty good. And of course, along the way, They keep feeding you. You get bring sandwiches to you, and they bring falafels and things like that. It's really something. So then I figured this will be the end of it. Anyway, I was a consultant at the time doing engineering work up by this young lady over here, who was from Boston, up in Haverhill, Massachusetts, and I stayed in North Andover at the Wyndham Hotel. And I got a call from my son Jeffrey. Got on the phone, he says, oh, by the way, he said, I'm over here at Kevin's house in the city. Like, well, what are you doing? Oh, having dinner here. Mary Kay Place is here, and Phoebe's here, and Kevin.
Mary Kay Place?
Yeah, yeah, she was there with Kevin and Phoebe Cates that evening when I got the call. And Kevin wanted to tell you that you did an excellent job playing in Owen's film. And having a swelled head to begin with, my head was like the Great Pumpkin. It was like blowing up a balloon like the Hindenburg, except it didn't explode. But you get that feeling. That was nice. You get a dizzy feeling. It made me feel really good. And I said, yeah, it was really nice of, you know, this guy has gotten an Academy Award for, you know, a movie. I forget the name of it. A Fish Called Wanda. Yeah.
Yeah, great movie with Jamie Lee Curtis.
Jamie Lee Curtis. So you're getting this feedback. So again, this was what happened. Finally, after this and this music video, I figured this would be finito, the end, finally. No such luck. The next thing that happened is a person came to my house with a piece of paper. It was a flyer. It said, we're looking around here to get you, not to get you, but looking around to get locations for our film project or studio or something like that. The next thing you know, we had in the house a team from NBC Universal doing a series called Pandora's Box, which is one of these murder recreation things they have, and all this stuff went on. So this girl, she brought in a crew, and it was a big professional crew, and they came into our house and stuff like that. This went on. All right, so we did two with her, two different episodes of something. We did Pandora's Box, and they came for 2 weekends or something, or 2 days or something. And the next thing you know, one of her contemporaries came up, another kid named Jonathan, and he was a location manager, and he was doing Homicide for the Holidays, which is was on the Oxygen Channel at the time. This is a true story. Now, listen, she's going to get
what a name for a series, huh?
Well, Homicide for the Holidays. And so they wanted to come up and do a scout. So they come up, and so this guy came up with a guy named Charlie Misak, who was the director, and this kid, when they were come in to look, and this director, Charlie, looked at me and says, Hillary, he says, you look like the guy that got murdered in this case. How would you like the job? And I said, I can't take it.
Well, you landed Homicide for the Holidays?
Homicide for the Holidays. I said, I was like, I did Hamlet with poison foils and stuff like that and fell down on everything. But that was the last time I ever did it. It was like, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. He puts me in a main role as the murder victim of this woman, who Susan Slayton, who came up from New York. We did the thing in our house. So the thing is, I couldn't believe it. And I said, gee whiz, it's just never going to end. I said, this is like a never-ending story. And what happened with that is, that thing is not really too famous, but I understand there's 11 million people watching this thing on this Oxygen Channel, this Homicide for the Holidays. And every year now, I get murdered again. They keep repeating it every holiday season in December. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's funny how everything comes full circle, because you mentioned Mary Kay Place earlier. Mm-hmm. She was in this movie called Diane, mm-hmm. directed by Kent Jones.
Yeah.
And Kent Jones was on the podcast, and he's the former director of the New York Film Festival.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's also good friends with a producer named David Permit, who's based in the West Coast, did the movie Face Off. David Permit's been on the podcast as well, which is funny. It's like a small world.
It's a very small world. And what I did was, when we got this job, of course, I touched base with my friend Owen, who gave me my first quote-unquote break. The only reason I got that job was because a guy named Larry Sloman, who had done a little film called The Black Balloon with the Safdie brothers, had to go to Las Vegas to write a book for and with Mike Tyson.
Interesting.
That's the interesting thing. So that's another reason that it's luck. It's like where you are at a certain time in space, and you just happen to step in it. I call it stepping in it. I don't think the other actors believe that. I say I'm being disrespectful or something, but I don't care. But you do. You get lucky. And so
I think that's part of the equation. But you have to be in the mix to be lucky. You have to be putting yourself out there, doing things and being proactive to even be in that situation, right?
Yes. They called me Motor Mouth in high school. I couldn't stop talking. But it's a thing. So this happened, and I called up Owen. I said, Owen, you won't believe this. I got this job and this victim of a homicide and all this. He says, how did that happen? How did that happen? He said, how did that happen? The guy director came in and looked at me and said, I look like this guy, because there was no dialogue. It was all pantomime. And even
did you have to play dead?
Not only did I have to play dead, I had to be murdered on cam.
Oh, wow.
Now, this was a very interesting thing, because, and let me relate this, because this is interesting to some of these young guys out here. And basically, I had an actor there with me by the name of Michael Wiener. Michael Wiener, I found out later. Now, this is true, and I'm not trying to scare anybody in this room. He's part of the Church of Satan. Satan! Can you believe this? Or something. I found out later. If I had known this before, I wouldn't have had him coming. It was my wife's cutlery set, my Wusthof German cutlery set with it, and a barbecue fork trying to kill me with this thing, right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile.
So not the actual killer. You're talking about the actor playing the killer.
He was actually, he scared the living, shall I say, feces out of me. It was really something. This guy looked like a homicidal maniac. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. He was really, when he was.
He's a full method. This guy.
He's a method actor. And of course, we're not talking. This is all pantomime. This is like 1925 in the film industry. And so basically, I'm on the ground and I fall down on the ground, and Charlie Mysak's like lying on the rug like a bear looking at me, falling down on the ground. And he says, do this, move this way. Because we didn't have sound. We just had, it was all silent. It was pantomime. There's no mic. I'm going like this and going like this and screaming. And then what I did was I practiced from WikiHow. How to play dead. So I did this. Silence. I can't keep too silent on this thing, but I did it so much. And this guy named Darius, who was the assistant director there, the AD, they call him in this business, he looked at me and said, Hillary, that was terrific, you know, really good. And then the girls were watching, and they said, Hillary, you did stunt acting. I said, I did. I did a stunt act. It was like stunt acting because I was so into it. I practiced it, and they say practice makes perfect. So, as I say, if you're into any modality in this business, practice your art, practice what you do, practice your technology, learn the latest types of things you can do in order to grow, I think. It's very important. It really is for younger people, for the young people. For me, I'm such an old thing. Anyway, so anyway, let me go on and keep going. I know I'm talking a lot, but this is a long thing, long-winded broadcast or whatever you call it. And so the next thing that happened was guys from college were found out about it, about the murder thing and everything. They're all blah, 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 blah. These are my classmates from a college in Vermont. And one of them said, why don't you call up Tim Gallen? And I said, Tim Gallen, that's Jimmy's brother, right? And this fellow Jimmy was in our class. He had already died at that time. He died a little early. Call him up. He's an actor. So I find out later that Tim Gallen, after I checked him out, he's one of the top stunt actors in the city. He did the stunt, coordinator or whatever it is for the following for Kevin Bacon. He drove the orangey red BMW into the East River for Splash with Daryl Hannah and
Splash directed by Ron Howard.
Splash directed by Ron Howard. So I figured. So I called him up and I said, "Oh, I just thought I'd talk to you because I've done this stuff. And do you have any advice?" This is what I said, just ask him for advice. They're telling me. He goes, and so he said, "Okay, I'll check it out for you. No problem." Next thing you know, about 2 or 3 or 4 weeks later, he calls me up and says, "There's this gal who's doing a showing of a little film she made down at the Women's Club, locally near where my house is." So I go down there and meet her. Her name is Eagle Carp. I find out she's a stunt actor as well, but she's also a person who takes in stray dogs out in the Bahamas, she calls them. And she had this movie she made called Potcake Dogs or something. And we saw it down there. It's how she takes them and she gets them placed in the United States. And this is part of her little thing that she does. But she's also.
Interesting.
Yeah, she's a stunt actor too. And she's done epic different. She's been in the John Wick series a lot.
Yeah.
Star there.
She lives there in Yonkers as well.
She does. She does live in Yonkers.
And
she does.
I should mention for the podcast, shout out to my aunt Terry Marini, who is neighbors with Hillary.
Hello, Aunt Terry.
Yeah, if she's listening to the podcast.
If she's listening. I'm making all kinds of mistakes here because I'm stumbling over the words and I'm stuttering and I haven't rehearsed anything.
No, it's all good. It's all love.
Please forgive me. Please forgive me. No tomatoes today, please. But that's that one. And so then I just gave her a little sample of what happened. After a while, she called me and said, "Hey, Hillary, can you help us? We're doing a passion project." So I said, "Uh-oh, this has to do with more murders. Someone's going to strangle me now," or something like that. She said, "Oh, no, this is a story about a thing we're going to do, a project to see if a passion project, maybe try to market it or something later." I said, "Okay." So I do it. So I had a job as a Southern lawyer. I think I know if I sent you that or not, the Southern lawyer. But it was a two-minute monologue that we actually did in our house in Yonkers. And believe it or not, we got it on take one. Now, don't ask me how this happened. It was 2 minutes and 1 second, actually.
Yeah.
Don't ask me how this happened. It just happened. So that was the end of that. And she was very happy, and she went on her merry way, and we had a little red carpet for the thing later on at her house and all this kind of things and the things they do and all the little bells and whistles.
Did you love it?
I thought it was rather gory because the theme of it was that she played the part of a young lady who was going around knocking off people who do bad things to animals. So she was going to do bad things to the people who did the bad things to the animals. It's catching. Right, I don't know, right. Whatever it is. So meanwhile, Evie gave me the reel. And then the reel, I was able to use that reel, and she did a couple of headshots for me.
And you know. Evie directed that, essentially.
Evie directed this thing.
How did she prepare? Like, how did you find her as a director? What sort of directing did she do?
I had to sit in her house and do this thing with, and her husband is sitting next to me, and he was convinced that I could do it, but after I did it, the monologue over there, they put me into the mix.
Did you do some, like, rehearsals? Did she give you a lot of notes?
I actually took that script, believe it or not, and I massaged it a little bit for them.
Yeah.
And made some, I've been doing some film editing since I've been doing that. I've done a couple of film editing jobs.
Really?
Script jobs, yeah. I've been doing that, too.
Oh, gotcha. Like script doctoring.
Yeah, script editing, I guess you call it. Yeah. Script editor, is it? So yeah. I've been doing that, and then all of a sudden, I guess somebody sent me a check to, I didn't expect it, and they sent me a check, so I'm a semi-professional
amazing
editor.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I catch these things, and I do this stuff, yeah. And I'm picky and all this kind of nonsense at my age.
Yeah.
And so basically that happened. And this particular thing, I was telling them that this Southern lawyer thing actually managed to be sent to John Lee Hancock, who was doing the little things with, not the little things, he didn't do the little things, he was doing this movie up in Connecticut called Mr. Harrigan's Phone for Netflix Global. But he had directed the little things, which was the last movie he had done prior to this. And all of a sudden I figured, oh, that's ridiculous. And the next thing, be up in Connecticut, get fitted, you're on. So that was
nice.
It started off as a featured BG job. And then it ended up with like about maybe, I'd say, 30-second monologue. It was a sentencing hearing. And so we were in the old Stanford courthouse. They had, I swear to God, these big movies. Like I'm telling you, there were 200 freaking people in this place all
amazing.
Over. And I'm sweating and I'm getting nervous and like I am now and I'm very nervous. Well, this is what happens when you're an actor and you have no experience really to fall back on. But anyway, they were there and we did about seven takes. We did it and we finally blocked it and got it all done and everything. And the only thing that I was telling her, the only thing that John Lee Hancock said to me were three words. The first word he's looked at me and he said, after we did the warm-up, the rehearsal, he looked at me and said, "Excellent." So I went, I'm going to forget these lines for sure now. And then as you get swelled up, you're not experienced. You know, you just, oh, yeah, okay. You get hardened in this thing a little bit.
Yeah.
And then he came back and said, "Good demeanor." We did seven takes.
Wow. Those are the three words, huh?
Those are the three words. Yeah. And I didn't even know. I was telling this young lady here. I said to her, I didn't know who in heck John this guy.
Doesn't Hancock it sound like one. The name of an assassin, John Lee Hancock?
No, I said to the I said to the HMU people. I said, "Hey, did this guy's great great grandfather sign the Declaration of Independence or something?" "Oh no, no." "Did his great grandfather start an insurance company in Boston?" "No." I said, "What kind of movies?" I don't know. "Oh, he did He did Saving Mr. Banks. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember that. It was Tom Hanks and about Mary Poppins and all this and Walt Disney and everything. Oh, yeah, I remember. That was a good movie. He says, everybody wants to work for this guy. I said, you're kidding. I said, what did he do last? So he said, here? I said, no. He said, The Little Things. And I didn't know who was in it. I heard it wasn't as well received as it probably should have been, but I said, who was in it? Denzel Washington, Jared Leto, and Rami Malek. And I went, ah! I was biting my hand. I said I couldn't believe it. I was with a director that had just finished directing these three stars. You get starstruck. This is what happens. You get holy.
He gave you good praise, so that's amazing.
It's encouragement. You have to think that you can do things if you push yourself a little bit. You got to get into it. You got to show that you're going to help. You're going to do something over and above what people expect of you, I think.
Yeah.
And I told the story about my shyness to you before when I was a little kid and I had to do the Shakespeare thing, blah, 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 for all my teachers. And that started me off and made me less worried about my way I was presenting myself than I do now. I don't care what people think. I could be a raving lunatic. I wouldn't care what they thought or anything else, because you just assume that role and you go forward. It's not like being a show-off. It's not really. Although acting is showing off to a degree, because you're playing a part of somebody else. Yeah. It's like that. You're doing a show, your show biz, and you're showing that you can actually do a part of a character that has been described to you by the authors of the script and the way the director and the producer really want you to do it. And I just follow their directions. Just take their directions and do it, and do it 25,000 times as much as you can, and read the script. Like I read up that Meryl Streep. She reads the scripts 100 times.
Really?
That's what she's told. That's now in the papers somewhere. Somebody told me that.
100 times.
100 times. Now, can I give you a sidebar on this? I have something to tell you about my granddaughter.
Yeah.
All right. I go to an agency in New York, and I get texts from them on my old-fashioned flip-top text message phone. I have no data. I don't take data. It's too confusing for me at my age. And there was a note from somebody down there at the agency said, do you know any Caucasian girls who are 11 to 15 years old with long natural hair, no dye, coming down between their shoulder blades? I said, yes, I do, my granddaughter. And guess what? I told them, I sent her picture down in her Halloween costume the October before. And they bookmarked her. Her name is such and such and such. Guess what happened? 12 hours later, they booked her for 3 days for the Gilded Age.
Wow.
The Gilded Age.
Amazing.
They booked her. Now, this is crazy. So basically what I did was I had done something that I thought would help, just to show them in case they had something that maybe Olivia can do something. Next thing, she's in the Gilded Age. We find ourselves, all of us, my daughter, my granddaughter, my wife, and myself, we're running back and forth to Garden City, New York, and they put us up in the hotel. They paid Olivia, my granddaughter, they paid her SAG compensation, gave her a $60 a day expense account or something over there. And you're saying, what the heck is this? This is ridiculous. And they had a waiver for the SAG. All the 25 girls, and they had some SAG and some not, but usually the first 25 are SAG after. In any film that the SAG-AFTRA has jurisdiction over. But some of them weren't, as my granddaughter was not. The first day she's on set, she's in an art class, and she's standing up in the back of the classroom in front of a potted palm. And there's this blonde girl next to her who's the teacher. And so I asked my wife, who's that? Oh, that's Louisa Jacobson. I said, Louisa Jacobson? Who the heck is Louisa Jacobson? Never heard of her. So I look her up, and I found out who her mother was. Guess who her mother was?
No idea.
Meryl Streep.
Wow.
I said, I almost fell on the floor. I said,
I would not have guessed.
I would never have guessed either. I said, I don't even know who the heck that is. My wife knows some of these things because she looks at it. You can bet your bottom bippy that, boy, when that Gilded Age came on, my wife was looking at that damn thing, like playing it again and looking at it 1,000 times.
At least 100 times.
100 times. It's ridiculous. But this is just like pure luck, but you want to make, when you're doing this kind of work, you want to make a little advance on what you're going to want to do and tell people what you want to do. And you'd be surprised if somebody needs that particular skill or needs that particular talent, if you will, you may be chosen before somebody else will because you look like you're more interested to do it.
That's I like what, how you say.
Yeah, you want to be in. You want to be into it. It's like stamp collecting. You're going to go put the stamps in the book.
Or it's like you say, you got to be lucky, but like even playing lotto, right? You got to be lucky to win lotto, but you have to be playing. You still have to buy the ticket.
You got to buy the ticket. You got to be in it to win it. That's how it works.
You got to be in it to win
it. I'm very lucky. I'm very grateful for all the help I've gotten from people in this business. The camaraderie is there. And when, so based on the, my, it's Evie Vaccaro, who is my, my I guess I leaped into a short project agreement there, which actually qualified me to go join a SAG-AFTRA. And I thought about it for 2 or 3 months and then finally said, oh, what the heck, I'll just do it. I'll just do it. $3,000 later, I was bankrupt, but I I joined the union. And ever since then, and then the, I started out, and then they started putting me in a few different roles and things. And when the last couple I did were, I was in the last scene of Ghostbusters 5. I was in the final
and the BG, as a BG?
As a just best featured BG. Yeah. That's all. I'm mostly
so
BG.
So what kind of, what other films have you been in as BG?
Oh, I just did Penguin. We finished up one of the last scenes in Penguin.
Is that a feature film or a series?
It's Netflix, I think. Netflix,
yeah,
I think. A series? No, wait, it's HBO or Netflix. No, it's not a series, it's a feature.
Oh, it's a film. Okay,
it's
cool.
It's a feature, yeah. So we did a car chase down on East 130th Street.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Who was directed that?
I'm not sure who the director was. All I know is I just was featured, and I just stood by. We had our cars set up, and they put the Gotham license plates on them, and we just stood there and reacted, basically.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's again, yeah.
How does one get into acting BG? Like, how if, like, somebody wanted to be an extra in a film, how would...
They would just start going to these background agencies. It's not a big deal. You got to pay monthly and all this stuff, and a lot of them don't get onto the set.
Oh, so you have to pay monthly to be considered?
Correct. But like I said, there are agencies in the city. Now, I got into a cost-plus agency now. So I'm lucky I don't have to pay any kind of monthly fees or anything. They just take a commission on my... they add money to the producer to take me in.
Gotcha.
So I...
Just keep the mic nice and close.
Yes, yes, yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Sorry, I'm pushing myself away.
Oh, it's okay.
Pushing myself. I guess I'm sliding around a little bit. But that's what happens. And that agency, I'll put a plug in here for him. It's Grant Wilfley.
Oh, I met him one time when I was younger because I used to work in commercial real estate.
Yep.
And I just walked into his office.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just remember meeting him and getting his business card. And I was like, Grant Wilfley. But at the time, I was like, when I was 19, 20 years old, I used to work in commercial real estate in Manhattan. So they used to make me canvas buildings from like the top floor to the bottom and go into every single office. And just collect business cards.
I tell you, this is how
I think he did work for The Sopranos. I think he used to cast for The Sopranos.
Cast a lot of interesting jobs. Yeah. A lot of movies, too. A lot of movies and things. If you're in there, you get calls, and then you find out that it rubs off on, like, my granddaughter, which she got. She finished off another three days with Russell Crowe's show, Poker Face, up in Orange County in Chester, New York. Yeah, she played. They had her out at some amusement park up there. So we spent 3 days with her up there last summer.
Nice.
Yeah, so that was interesting too. But like I say, it's a matter of just putting your best foot forward. It's not so much working night and day trying to get into showbiz. You need a representative, I think. This is very important. When some of these players came to my house to do Homicide for the Holidays and the other one, Pandora's Box and this and that, they all said, Gee, I wish I had an agent. But you have to start somewhere, and you start with Background Inc. or you start with Durant or somebody else and do that and then just keep plugging yourself a little bit. I didn't get any kind of endorsements from Owen or anybody else when I was doing these treading on the water there, so to speak, to try to get something. It was a matter of just trying to keep applying and keep applying yourself and sign up for these things.
Yeah, just getting in the mix.
Get in the mix. If you're in the mix and they need somebody your age or whatever it is they're looking for, because basically they're just looking for faces in BG. They're not looking for, and they're looking, then they have, of course, in SAG we have all these different diversity requirements and everything that we have, that the producers have agreed to and things like that. And so basically we do that, and sometimes you fill the bill and sometimes you don't.
Yeah, sounds good.
It's good. It's a good application. It's good.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Hillary, now we're going to move on to the second portion of the podcast where we discuss two movie scenes that you love. And one is from The Wizard of Oz.
May I comment now?
Yes.
I'm going to tell you something. I came to the conclusion that The Wizard of Oz was not a series of scenes. It is one large tapestry. It's not really one scene that we're going to pick out of that thing that was the best, because we're going to have everybody saying when the witch sent the monkeys out or something like that.
Right,
that
right.
was a terrific scene.
True.
But the import of the scene, what I call Wonderland, all right, Wonderland is the scene, and that those things that they did, all the different ones that you could cherry pick them out, you could say, this is my favorite, that's my favorite. I can't make up my mind about Alice in Wonderland. I think the whole thing as a whole is a work of art, like a tapestry almost.
Yeah.
There were very few scenes in there, in that Wonderland part of it, when she stepped into the Wonder area, whatever it is, that were tremendously poignant. They all had a certain strength that were about on the same wavelength. To me, others can say something else, but you could take many of those different scenes. The clicking of the heels. There's no place like home, of course.
Yeah.
There's no place like home.
There's no place like home. And yeah. What's amazing about the film, I just saw it the other day for the first time in a very long time. And I showed it to my daughter, who's 5 years old. It's just it's amazing how, and I think that's how old I was when I first saw the movie. And it's amazing how well that film holds up. That's what I was thinking about the other day when I was watching it. I was like, wow, you know what? This movie is from the 1930s.
1939.
Judy Garland.
August 25th, 1939, yeah. It was released.
Yeah, and it was based off a book by L. Frank Baum. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah. It was amazing. Victor Fleming was the director.
Yes, yes.
And... Yeah. Yeah, it just, I thought it was the story and the visuals just totally hold up.
The basis for a lot of the things they do today, they had that set the standard for all those special effects and all kinds of different things.
Even color. The production design was incredible.
The production, these art people in that film are just absolutely, you know, you can't even compete with that today. Everything is done with of digital stuff today.
Right, yeah, that was all done by hand.
It's all done by hand, and there's a difference between the David when the Academy in Florence and the models they sell in New York to take home with you from the museum.
Right, right.
I was there once, and I asked this guy who was our guide, I said, Signore, per favore, I said, hey, how did Michelangelo, in Italian, it's Michele Agnolo, they say. I said, how long, I just said, how big was his school that was with him when he did the David? Signore, no, it works solitario. I said, solitario? You mean by himself? He said, si, solitario. I said, wow, that is freaking absolutely incredible. I couldn't get over it. I looked at this David. He's standing in the Academia. He's got that rock in his hand and that sling. He's stark ass naked standing there. Even nuns go in there and look at this stuff. They stay there. They stay longer than other people. And the thing is that looking out the side, and if you look at him and you start tripping out almost, because you can see almost the blood flowing through his veins, and he's getting ready to haul that rocket Goliath. It's just an amazing piece of work. And that's what The Wizard of Oz is to me. It's a unique, handmade, just huge, beautiful work of art to me. And don't laugh. I can comment freely on this. Guess what I did in 1970? I'll tell you. I managed an art gallery.
I thought you were going to say, listen to Pink Floyd while watching The Wizard of Oz.
No, that's later on. That's late in the 60s. That was back in the 60s. In 1970, I managed an art gallery, and the art gallery was Hammer Galleries. Hammer Galleries was run by an industrialist named Armand Hammer, whose grandson got into trouble for trying to barbecue his wife or something and was kicked out of showbiz.
Oh, yeah. Hammer.
Army Hammer was kicked out. But I managed it for him and Victor Hammer, and his was his brother who went to Princeton, came out with a degree in art history in 1930, and he was the fellow who was my boss, and he and I were doing the thing. And I got the job through a guy who was from Cleveland, who got me the job and that they needed a manager. What they did was they used to just liquidate these guys after a while or something and blah, 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 blah. But anyway, to make a long story short, we met some very interesting characters down there. We met Greta Garbo, and I got a call from this kid, Tony Metzger, who was out of Shaker Heights. His niece was Daryl Hannah, by the way.
Wow.
Because his sister was married to a guy named Bill Hannah who ran a fleet of tugboats out on Lake Michigan at one time. And she was one of the offspring of Bill Hannah and Susan Metzger, who was his sister. Anyway, he goes, look, get down in the gallery. He's down there with Mr. Soans, the salesman, Mr. Mitchell, Bill Mitchell. I said, who's down there? He said, President Johnson and C. Arnold Smith are down there. This is true. This is a true story. This is a funny story, getting a little away from the topic we're discussing, but it's part of presenting yourself properly. So I went out, and I shook hands. I saw the president, and I said, Mr. President, it's a great pleasure to meet you. Welcome to Hammer Galleries today. He looked at me, and he says, what's your name? I said, I'm Hillary Duncanson. He said, donkey? And I retorted, and I said, Mr. President, isn't that the mascot of the Democratic Party? He looked at me and scowled with a very vicious look on his face and all of a sudden burst out laughing like hell. And I tell you, that's how you make points when you want to be an actor, okay? That's how you got to have a big set of whatever you need to be able to push yourself a little bit. Don't be afraid.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid because you're dealing with people that want you to do things like that. That's what they want. Wow. They want to see how you react. I believe acting, and I may be way out of line here, I don't know, but I believe acting, and I'm not saying I'm a good actor, I'm just a half-assed actor, but I would say this, it's reacting. It's reacting to what you're getting, the inputs that you're getting. And I guess I would consider myself a quasi-amateur method actor because I react and I just try to go with the methodology of what's happening. I don't look at anything too importantly, I just feel it, and then you just let it out. It's a feeling that you get when you're doing the acting, and then you just let it out.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's not hard as long as you're not self-conscious. You don't care if you're running around the street with a bikini on or something, and you're a man or something. It doesn't make any difference. Just do it. Just go do it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is there any other thoughts or feelings that you want to share about The Wizard of Oz?
Well,
how old were you when you first saw the film?
As I told you, I think I sent you a text or something. I talked to you. I said, I think we were about 5 or 6 years old. We saw The Wizard of Oz. I went with my cousins. And I want to tell you, and I'm going to use a little vulgarity here, if you don't mind. It scared the living shit out of us with that woman, with that Margaret Hamilton and that freaking black dress and that green face and that funny wand and those monkeys, which we were having nightmares about for weeks thereafter. We probably should have gone to a psychiatrist, a child. That's
and were they screening in a movie theater or somewhere?
They were screaming. The kids were screaming.
No, but like you saw it in a theater.
In the theater, yes. It was in the theater. We were like 6, 7 years old. They played it again, and we went to see it. My mother and my Aunt Agnes, we went, and we went to see that. And it was really scary, and we blah, blah, blah. But like I said, the effect was tremendous.
And this is when, in the 1950s?
Oh, it was probably in the late 40s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, maybe 1950, something, late 40s, 1949, 1950, something like that.
Amazing.
Yeah, and it was just terrific, and it did what it had to do, and it made you cry. And it made you scared, and it made you feel things, emotions that you really don't feel at that age sometimes.
Yeah.
You don't really get that kind of stimulus, if you will, of any kind of violence like that or anything with love and all these different emotions that are brought into it. It really was probably one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life. It still is.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's definitely a masterpiece.
It is. It is. And it has, and like I said, the scenes. Very hard to pick one big scene out of a movie like that. It's all good and great and wonderful.
You know? Nice.
Yeah. It's a composite to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent.
Yep.
And
by the way, guys, even if it stops, we're still rolling audio. It's okay.
So, all right. So now we're going to talk about the next film, which is Five Easy Pieces.
This is a film that came out.
Starring Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. That was Jack Nicholson. This thing came out in 1970. And had Karen Black as the co-star with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. She was great in it.
She's terrific.
Yeah.
Terrific woman.
I haven't seen her in a lot of films. I was looking her up after I watched the film. And I watched the film. I had never seen it before until the other day in preparation for this podcast. But that's one of the things I love about doing this podcast is it forces me to watch films. Not that I wouldn't have watched that film. I've definitely heard of it. There's so many movies, it's hard to get them all in. But, yeah, I really enjoyed watching it.
It's a classic. It's a classic. It is a turnaround, basically, that the critics called a turnaround from the general American movies that we made at that time here in the United States, American made.
How would you describe the film for people that are not familiar with it?
Gritty.
It's a character-driven piece about a young guy, right. Which it's interesting at first because you're like, okay, this guy comes from this working class background. Like, he's in a relationship with this woman. They're not quite engaged or married,
Jack Nicholson came from a pretty well-to-do background.
He does come from a well-to-do background, but in the beginning of the film, it's a reveal.
Right.
It's when he goes back home that he has a well-to-do background. Because in the beginning of the film, he's working on an oil rig.
Yeah, it's gritty.
It's gritty. There's hints toward it, by the way, that he comes from a well-to-do background. But that's not in the beginning of the movie. In the beginning of the movie, he's in this town. It looks like he's in Texas, and he works on an oil rig, and like his friend lives in a trailer park.
Correct.
And like they're drinking beers and hanging out in the bowling alley. And then he gets word that his dad is sick.
Had a stroke.
Had a stroke.
Right.
And then he goes back home while his girlfriend, played by Karen Black, convinces him to take the trip, to go on the trip with him. He's okay, I'll bring you with me. But he makes her stay at a motel while he's like really hanging out with the family, at least for the first couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a really interesting dynamic of kind of what was going on with his character, because it's like he was almost rejecting it seemed like his siblings, they're a very musical family, really well educated.
Right.
His brother and his sisters they seem like accomplished piano players. Like his sister, when we first meet her, she's some sort of session pianist at a recording studio.
The one I like, one of the scenes I like, okay, it's hard to really pick best scenes out of these things.
What's the scene that sticks out with you?
One that he was talking to his father after he had the stroke.
Yeah.
At the end.
And he's crying, actually. It's a rare scene. I was thinking about that when I was watching it, because so there's a scene where his dad, he's walking with his dad and outdoors and just like taking him for a walk. And then he's just talking about his life a little bit and how he's been this drifter and how his dad really wouldn't approve of his lifestyle. And then he starts breaking down and crying. And I'm like, wow, it's wild to see Jack Nicholson in this role where he's crying, because that is not the Jack Nicholson that I'm used to seeing in any other film.
That's what makes it so almost unique, the way he was in that one. He did have his nasty outbursts.
Of course, he had very Jack Nicholson moments in this film, for sure, and he had he still had his Jack Nicholson persona, but like he did have this moment of vulnerability here. Yeah.
Did you have a favorite scene of your own, by any chance? Or?
I actually, for some reason, I really like the scene in the diner where he's trying to order, he's trying to make like a substitution on his order.
The famous slice of toast.
He's with his girlfriend and also with these two hitchhikers that I really liked their performances as well. And one of them seemed really unhinged. And they stop off at this diner and he's trying to order toast, some sort of buttered toast. And they're like, nope, no substitution. The waitress is just not having it. Because unless it comes with that combination, you can't order it. And then he's like, could you give me a chicken sandwich and I'll pay for the chicken sandwich, but instead of putting the chicken in, don't put the chicken in and I'll just have the bread. And then they basically get kicked out of the diner. You know what? It's actually an interesting, I was thinking about this really in depth, because this is something, it's something that somebody that comes from money would do. I don't care. Just charge me for this. I've seen people like from Bronxville do stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like I have a friend that would do something like that. But like somebody that really comes from like a working class background would never do that, because it's just like wasteful and like it's like a waste of money. But like it was an interesting reveal. Like he wanted that toast and he just wasn't having it. And it's like also a character reveal. Like he doesn't want to play by the rules because it's so I like when there's things that are, it's almost like a non sequitur, but it says so much about that character.
a character is juxtaposed. He's juxtaposed between his background and what he feels in his heart that he wants to do. This is just his will. It's
yes,
you
know, exactly.
You can't tell if he's crazy. You can't tell if he's sane. You can't tell what his motives are. It's just he. It's just him. But it's just right. The way he did things. And yeah. It was just a little bit of a takeoff on the normal plots, if you will, that American films had. I have a beginning, got a middle, and an end. That's how we do it. This kept rolling into different aspects of his character and kept presenting him.
Yeah, for sure. And it definitely personified films of the 70s. And the 70s is definitely like a golden age of cinema in a lot of ways, where so many great directors came from that.
Yeah.
Came from that era. Who was the director of?
I hope I can answer this one.
I have to look this up. This is where if we had a show producer here. Okay, Five Easy Pieces was directed by, and I looked it up last night. I should have had these notes.
It was one of the best efforts they made, I think, in their careers, I think.
Yeah. Bob Rafelson.
There you go. There you go. And then it was the writer, the lady who wrote it. That was also a big change, a sea change for film at the time.
Yeah.
The way she did the script, and almost in little character studies.
It was written by Carol Eastman.
Yes. Yeah.
And Carol Eastman, I'm trying to see if she had written anything else that was known. Not as well known as that. For sure. But yeah, I thought it was brilliant. A brilliant character-driven film. And yeah, I really enjoyed it, actually. So I appreciate you putting me onto it.
Well, that's one I liked because I could remember it. I had to look it up, of course, to get some of the details. At my age, I get a little fuzzy.
Is that one that you saw in the cinemas when it came out?
I saw it. Marcy and I saw it when it came out. We were watching a lot of stuff then. We were watching a lot of movies then.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, that was really amazing, some of the stuff that was done out there. Yeah. We went down, as a matter of fact, right around that time.
Remember where you saw it?
I don't know, down the city probably somewhere. But that was like right after we had gone to Carnegie Hall and saw Neil Young and Leonard Ronstadt.
Oh, wow.
And that night,
night?
That was a different night we were down there, but it was similar. It was around the same time frame, I think. And we had been there, and that night they stopped the show, and they announced that we had achieved an end to the war in Vietnam. That was pretty crazy. You just want to see 3,000-4,000 joints light up at once. It was amazing. It was terrific.
Yeah.
It was an amazing night that night. And that's what
so it was like 1973
or something like that. 73 in that genre, in that same genre, something like that.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, so that was pretty interesting. So that whole thing was a big thing back in those days. It was pretty divided in the country at that point.
Yeah.
So I'm not taking political sides or anything, but you got a guy like Ho Chi Minh who was at the Paris Peace Conference in the First World War and the Second World War, and was on our side in both wars.
Yeah.
And then they had it gets these politicians, they change the politician, and then the whole thing gets mixed up.
Yeah, that's a rough
one.
So
it was a, I don't know what the results are, but you pay your money, you take your choice. That's what they say.
That's true. Yeah.
So that's what happens sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Hillary, we're so glad that you were on the Film Situation podcast. And
this is my first virgin podcast.
I'm glad you
podcast
broke your podcast virginity on this podcast.
So it's very nice to be here. I've never done one before. I've been studying and blah, 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 you know.
Do you listen to podcasts? Are you a podcast listener?
I read books.
Yeah.
Always read. I don't watch too much video stuff.
Yeah.
Music video I'll look at once in a while.
Yeah. Thank you again.
Oh, and you're welcome, of course. Yeah. You're welcome.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the Film Situation podcast, hosted by Zef Kota. Executive Producer Jeff Cutler. Original music by Yuri Ryback.